learned that the British didn't like Jabotinsky. All right, he didn't really fit into their plans. So in 1930, when he was in South Africa on a speaking tour, the British consulate called him in and they said, and by the way, you're not invited back to Palestine. We're locking you out of the country, you're a rabble-rouser, we don't need you at all. So Jabotinsky would now spend his years in Vienna, Paris, Berlin, and ultimately New York City. And during these years, particularly in the early 1930s, he began admiring Mr. Mussolini, El Duce, and his writings, and some of his followers much more so even than him. In fact, through contacts made with the government of Italy, there was something from 1934 to 38 called the Beitar Naval Academy. Now, Beitar, we're going to talk about in a moment. Beitar is the Zionist Revisionist Youth Group, which is still active today. Again, we talked about all the while he's warning Polish Jews and other Jews wherever he goes, particularly in Eastern Europe, they're living, quote, on the edge of a volcano. That's a phrase that he used over and over. We talked about the 10-year evacuation plan that he negotiated with the governments. Meanwhile, not only were his relationships with the British not so good, but his relationship with the Zionist organization wasn't so good either. Now, it would get a lot worse in the 1940s after he's gone, and we're going to talk more about that in the section on World War II, but just as a preview, there was a period when the labor socialists were helping the British hunt down the militia Irgun members of the revisionist movement, including guys like Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, who would wind up becoming prime ministers of the State of Israel. So there was a mini-Jewish civil war that was prompted by these ideologies as well. And it's amazing that it didn't become more so. Yeah.
Jabotinsky died in the U.S.
Yeah, he was at a summer youth camp.
Was there ever any discussion about he was assassinated?
No, he had a heart attack. I've never seen any.
Right, but in 1940, did they think in those terms, such that he had a heart attack? Could he have been poisoned? Could he have been whatever? A lot of people didn't like him.
Right. I haven't heard that. I haven't read that anywhere. I haven't exhausted the material, but I've never come across it.
Unless he had a history of heart disease.
What?
Unless he had a history of heart disease.
Yeah, I don't know. Every source says that he just died of a heart attack. Yeah.
I mean, that's whatever.
Yeah, including, there's a biography of him by this guy, Joseph Shechtman, who was one of his lieutenants. And Shechtman doesn't bring that up at all. And he was probably more likely than anyone to bring up something like that if there were rumors of it. So I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, just a thought.
One too many matzo balls.
Yeah, he was a trim, fit guy.
He was a
cholent.
Yeah,
he was trying to kiss up to the religious again. So we remember one of the things that strained tensions a great deal was the 1933 Lazarov assassination. Does anybody remember that?
On the
beach in Tel Aviv. Lazarov was the guy who negotiated the transfer agreement with the Nazis that enabled Jews to come out of Germany with a certain amount of German goods that they had to purchase and then could sell in Israel or Palestine. Or Lazarov was walking down the beach with his wife Sima one night, and two or three guys, I've read different numbers, came up to Lazarov. One of them put a gun to his head and assassinated him. Or Lazarov was the brilliant, young darling. He was 33 years old in 1933 of the socialist movement. So there was a trial, and it pitted the sides against one another. A guy named Stavsky was actually convicted, and then was overturned on appeal. And really, until this day, in some circles, they still talk about that trial. Then, in October 1933, not long after this, Jabotinsky told Beitar members, if they wanted to emigrate, not to do so through the Zionist organization's Jewish agency, but to negotiate directly with employers in Palestine, which was another way that you could get a certificate of admission to Palestine versus the strict quota system that the Zionist organization had. They were entitled to invite people to come to Palestine. So the Jewish agency, in turn, and this is hitting people where they're at, right? Immigration, you know, where it hurts. The Jewish agency instructed agents to no longer give immigration permits to Beit Torah members. So you're not coming in through us anyway, so it doesn't matter. The revisionist said, don't give to the JNF, the Jewish National Fund, and we're going to start our own funds for you to give money to if you want to. The revisionists set up their own union in Israel, which is kind of funny because they were pro-business. But the revisionists also took to it to bust strikes on behalf of certain businesses in Israel. There was a lot of bad blood, and there were people being beaten up in the streets. Not everywhere every day, but stuff was happening. And what you also have is the revisionists have set up parallel structures to the Zionist movement. There are two competing Zionist movements in operation now. Were it not for the Holocaust, the situation would have lasted a lot longer, but the war basically wiped out the hardcore differences, the structural differences at least. David Ben-Gurion even went around calling Jabotinsky Vladimir Hitler, and that was in the Stanislavski book. I saw a reference to that there as well. There was an effort at rapprochement. Ben-Gurion and Jabotinsky met in London at the behest of some others. They apparently got along rather well. They met several times. They came up with a draft agreement of how their movements would not work to cut each other's throats anymore.
They called each other brother.
Ben-Gurion referred him as my friend, Chaver. Yet the movements rejected the agreement. So the rank and file were a little more raucous than the leaders were. Remember,
to show I'm never going to go into.
Right. And we spoke a few minutes ago that when you're a leader, you make certain compromises. And that was a compromise, certainly, that Jabotinsky and Ben-Gurion made. All along, the Zionist organization was upset with Jabotinsky and his followers for breaking what they referred to as Zionist discipline. Now, Zionist discipline was important because they wanted one voice talking to the British, for obvious reasons. You want to have one person to deal with. It got so bad that in 1935, Jabotinsky and his followers founded a new Zionist organization, and it was literally called the New Zionist Organization, NZO. And it was so literally had absolute parallel structures now. It definitely had popularity. Listen to this. At their first conference in Vienna in 35, 713 revisionists voted for delegates. Right, you send things out to the communities, just like they still do that, by the way, for the Zionist congresses today. And I voted in some. Anyone else ever vote in them? I don't know how I even get the thing. Oh, I think from the conservative movement's Merkaz group. So there were 713,000 revisionist votes for delegates. At the 19th Zionist Congress, the Zionist organization's operation, there were 635,000 votes. So they outpolled them. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they were more popular. It means that the Zionist organization was more institutionalized, and people weren't as excited about it anymore. But it also means there are 713,000 people that cared enough to vote for the revisionists. They're not an insignificant operation. Ultimately, they would return to the Zionist organization formally in 1946, with World War II finally being over. And the reasons they said they could do it was because in 42, as we mentioned, in the Biltmore Conference, the Zionist organization said that the goal now is a Jewish state in Palestine. And it's, even today, it's kind of funny to say that phrase, Jewish state in Palestine, because you just think of the phrase Israel so much. We mentioned he died in 1940 of a heart attack while at a Beitar summer youth camp in the upstate New York. He was buried in New York. He said he didn't want to be buried in Palestine until a Jewish government ruled there. In 1948-49, David Ben-Gurion said, there's no way that guy's being buried here on my watch. You know, Vladimir Hitler, even though we had an agreement at one point, the stuff he did after that, no way. It would be until 1964, as we saw in the film, that Jabotinsky and his wife were reinterred on Mount Herzl in Israel. And that was in 64 because Ben-Gurion left office in 63, and Prime Minister Levi Eshkol wanted to heal the wounds of the nation because those wounds were still strong, and he felt that would be a positive way to do that. He was a labor Zionist as well. His legacy. You mentioned, actually, that he's got more parks and streets named after him than anyone else. That came from the Yediot Ahronot newspaper in Israel, so I did find that. And literally everywhere you can go in Israel, you see a Jabotinsky Street, which is not unusual. His legacy also is he's the apostle of right-wing secular Zionism. His legacy is Menachem Begin's Chirut Party, which became the Likud Party, which rules the land of Israel, the government of Israel, actually the land of Israel today. I don't want to necessarily say the state of Israel. It depends on where you sit on the West Bank and, you know, Golan Heights. All right. Another legacy is the Beitar Youth Movement, which I've spoken about. And Beitar is B-E-T-A-R, or sometimes B-E-I-T-A-R. It was founded by Jabotinsky in 1923 in Riga, Latvia. Remember, he had a lot of support in Latvia. It was named for the last standing fortress in the Bar Kokhba Rebellion in 135 CE. And we've said it before, and I'll say it again, Jewish history stopped for these guys in 135 CE. It was actually in 136, but the major rebellion was over in 135. The motto was, be proud, generous, and fierce. And let's see if I have... Oh, I forgot to mention... I mentioned that there was an attachment or an adherence to Mussolini's ideology. Mussolini apparently liked Jabotinsky too. For Zionism to succeed, you need to have a Jewish state with a Jewish flag and a Jewish language. The man who really understands this is your fascist Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky was not a fascist. Some people saw him as such, but he was a Democrat with a small d, and that he believed in a free press, and he believed in liberal values such as free speech.
But for Mussolini to say that, that was a compliment.
Exactly. Absolutely, it was a compliment.
Fascism ties together all the different disparate parts.
Right.
It makes it a strong one-party system.
And it enables the people to know what direction to go in. You don't have anarchy. It's an answer to anarchy.
Until the Italians hooked up.
And the trains run on time.
And the trains run on time.
Until the Italians hooked up with the Nazis, or until the Germans began to become more and more part of, he did a lot of good for the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And the country was a mess. It hadn't been unified too many years earlier. Unification only had come in 1871, and it was pretty rough. Beitar was known for its militarism. So there was a formation in Berlin.
Kind of looks like the Hitler Youth a little, doesn't it?
Yep. It fit what was going on in that era. And that's the important thing to understand. Not that it was Hitler Youth, but that it shared the trappings of militarism, which all of these groups did at that time. And it doesn't look like your typical collection of Jewish kids, by any stretch of the imagination. It's not what we think of when we think of Jewish youth groups, to say the least. All right. Like other socialist youth groups, the emphasis was on learning Hebrew, making Aliyah, and being loyal to the Jewish people. They defined it in a certain way. Unlike socialist youth groups, as I said, they were very militaristic. You could see them marching through the streets of Jewish neighborhoods. They wore uniforms. They saluted. They had parades. They were like the youth groups of the fascist countries. Jabotinsky felt that militarism was good for the Jewish people after centuries of not being in arms. It would instill discipline, which would enable them to achieve their goals. And again, it all fit with Europe's growing fascist tie. By 1934, there were 70,000 members of Beitar, and 40,000 of them were in Poland. There were ties with the Polish nationalist movement, which helped train some Beitar youth group members in light arms fire. And the Beitar guys, by the way, and this were all boys, the Beitar guys would go on to play a significant role in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Mordechai Anilevich, who was really the hero of that, if you can say there are heroes in that tragedy, started with the Beitar youth movement, and then he was with HaShomer HaTzair, but he got his training in the Beitar youth movement. a little more on admiring Mussolini's fascist Italy. He saw it as another historical people rising up to meet their share of destiny. That's exactly what the Italian people were doing. That's what the Jewish people should do. And he was looking for allies, which makes total sense. For a short period, Betar adopted black shirts, just like the fascists in Italy and Germany. They began the broke ties. It took a few years when Mussolini invaded Ethiopia. They considered that cowardly. Although, anybody know what Ethiopia was called then?
Abyssinia.
Yeah. And I think the borders were the same, but I'm not sure. 1934, there was the creation of the Betar Naval Academy, which really fascinates me. I want to find out more about this. They trained Betar members from Europe, Palestine, and South Africa, a few dozen here, a few dozen there, over 4 years, 34 to 38. Some of them, by the way, would go on to serve with distinction in Israel's Navy in the years to come. One Italian newspaper wrote, in agreement of all the relevant authorities, it has been confirmed that the views and the political and social inclinations of revisionists are known and that they are absolutely in accordance with the fascist doctrine. So, they're kosher. Therefore, as our students, they will bring the Italian and fascist culture to Palestine. They saw this, the Italians, as a way of getting at the British. So this is kind of how the dominoes were beginning to stack up in Europe. 1938, toward the end of the Betar Sailing Academy, they launched that ship, the Sarah 1, to sail around the Mediterranean. Its distinction was that in Tunisia, they got in a fight with the local Arabs. Not surprising. They visited Haifa and were hailed as the, quote, first Jewish training ship in modern history. And cooperation really ended with the start of World War II.
Let me see if I have. We're going to get to the underground next. Not quite the underground yet. Revisionism
had its militia, too. The Etzel, the Irgun Sba'i Le'umi, or the organization the army organization for national Irgun organization Sfai Army Lumi National Army Organization. And let me see if I have. I'm gonna come back to this. All right, here we go. I figured we could see good old Walter Cronkite. Hang on. Walter, what happened to you? Oh, there it is.
The group in Kenya, Malaysia, Vietnam all used campaigns of terror in their struggles to end colonial rule. And the Jewish
state militia of the
Irgun was born of violence too, in part at the hands of groups that use the tactics of terror. One of these groups was known as the Irgun. Yosef Machmias joined the Irgun when he was 15, becoming part of the armed resistance that was surfacing in the region.
I had no choice. I had to fight. I had to take arms. Otherwise, I won't have a free state as I've got it today.
Their aim? To force out the British, who ruled the area then known as Palestine, and was heavily populated by Arabs, and create a Jewish state. The Irgun actually had formed in the early 30s as an underground movement. It advocated armed struggle against the British, who earlier in the century had committed to creating a homeland for the Jews. Their objectives gained new urgency following World War II and the Holocaust. Thousands of Jewish refugees from Europe surged toward Palestine, straining the already fragile relations between Arabs and Jews. The British response was to close the borders to the influx.
He used to come towards the Mediterranean and to the shores of Eretz Israel. The British won't let them in. They'll send them back to high seas at the beginning. And many of our brothers were drowned after they escaped from Europe. They were drowned because the British won't let them in. And that's the reason that we thought that we must fight the British.
It made the resistance movements even more determined.
We used to smuggle arms inside fish barrels. There was salted fish barrels. And they used to bring it to my parents' house. My mother used to open and clean the weapons and all, and then they would take it out. There were German weapons, Italian weapons, from all kinds. Whatever could shoot this would be all right for us.
The leader of the Irgun was a young Polish refugee named Menachem Begin.
He took over in 44, actually. He got to Palestine in 42.
Begin advocated violence against the British authorities in Palestine using guns, bombs, and fear. It was a calculated move.
Almost all terrorist campaigns before those in Palestine in the 1940s were localized affairs. But the Jewish terrorists went a step beyond that, and they played to an audience far beyond the footprints of the, let's say, the locus of conflict. But firstly to London, they played directly to the capital to try to influence public opinion further in afield in a means to achieve their aims. They also, and I think fascinatingly, played to an audience in New York because the nascent United Nations had just been organized. And their acts of violence were directed or communicated to diplomats designed to put pressure on Britain.
Begin believed that if the resistance could destroy the will and prestige of the British authority, they would depart, leaving the land of Israel to the Jews. Most of the Jewish resistance appealed to the Irgun to stand down. They wanted a diplomatic solution.
The Irgun were described as terrorists not just by the British, who were their enemies, but also by the Jewish community. The focus of their attacks was primarily the British government, its servants, its security forces in Palestine. And they concentrated in the main against British military, intelligence, and governmental targets, not against British civilians.
Begin's Irgun began to plan a major operation against a symbol of British power, the King David Hotel in Jerusalem.
King David Hotel was the headquarters of the British Army and the British regime in that side. The Irgun found out that there is a pillar in the cellar on the southern part of the southern of the hotel. If there's an explosion there, all the southern part of the hotel will be demolished. We started scouting the place, and we find out that every morning there's a truck coming from Ramallah with milk containers. We decided this is the way we're going to go in.
The Irgun claims that its violence was aimed at British symbols and that it often warned targets to evacuate before an attack to minimize civilian casualties. Whether a warning went out on the morning of July 22, 1946 is still unclear.
We waited for that truck from Ramallah. We overcame them. We took the containers out. We put a milk container, but instead of milk, there was explosives. And our guys, they were disguised as Arabs, and they went immediately to the King David Hotel. 22 minutes after we left the place, there was a big explosion, and as planned, all the southern part was demolished, but unfortunately, people died there.
91 people were killed, most of them Arabs. 28 of the dead were British. It was the deadliest operation of its time. The British were stunned, but unyielding. They clamped down on the Irgun, hanging Jewish militants in an effort to deter further violence. The Irgun responded with their own form of terrorist justice.
There are two British sergeants in the British intelligence. We kidnapped them. We sentenced them to death, and we told the British they'll hang our guy, we'll hang those two sergeants. and we hanged those two sergeants in one of the forests there. The small and the weak, and at that time we were the small and the weak, are allowed to do some things that the strong and the powerful cannot do. And this is the critical difference. If you are small and weak, then necessity has no bounds, and people will forgive you for almost anything. If you are big and strong, then of course you always have the choice. You can either choose to fight or not to fight. Ultimately, the British chose not to fight. And while there were many factors involved in their final decision to leave, the violence perpetrated by the Jewish resistance accelerated that decision. On May 14, 1948, the new State of Israel was proclaimed.
What I did then, I fought for my country, which was given to me by God. Sometimes in war, even a civilian here and there get hit. I won't call it violence, I call it the defending myself. It was necessary to fight just to liberate my country, and that's why I took arms and fought the British.
Probably the Irgun's lasting legacy on the general field of terrorism that goes beyond just the creation of Israel is that Begin himself, he understood the power of the media in transmitting a message. And this was a lesson I think almost every terrorist movement worth its salt since the 1940s has absorbed: the power of communication, the importance of reaching an audience outside the immediate locus of conflict, and transmitting a message as a means to marshal support, apply pressure on your enemy, but also as a means to try to spin the publicity one obtains from violence into a form of attention, then recognition, then respectability, then legitimacy, and then hopefully coming to power.
In fact, the man who marshaled support and gained publicity from violence would later become Prime Minister of Israel and be hailed as a peacemaker. Menachem Begin shared the 1978 Nobel Prize with Egypt's Anwar Sadat for the making of peace between Israel and Egypt. The Irgun's legacy would be a model for liberation movements that followed. In the 1950s, the bloody Algerian struggle for independence from the French.
Well, it was part of a greater documentary on groups like that. And that's what the Irgun became. We're going to spend a few minutes now looking at just what preceded that, but I wanted to slip that video in because the Irgun often doesn't get enough credit for being a substantial movement in the Zionist world.
What that historian said, though, is something that the Palestinians are saying, and it describes the Palestinians' perspective. The ironies, I wonder.
Sure.
They refuse to recognize the ironies.
Well, the first rule of spycraft is, you know, once you do something, you know, your people who are beneath you or observing you are going to do the exact same thing the next day. So, you know, what we do, like now, Israel has drones. Now the Hamas and Hezbollah have drones. So,
right. Oh, that was the argument, by the way, against getting a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
For exactly.
Right. Raising the stakes. Take a look at Irgun's motto. What do you notice?
Just the gun.
The map.
Look at the map.
Yeah.
Both banks. And this is as Rakaka, which really means just like this or just this way. And it's clearly a military symbol as well. So, one of my favorite books is Howard Sacher's book, The History of Modern Israel. And he wrote, "The policy of the new organization was based squarely on Jabotinsky's teaching. Every Jew had the right to enter Palestine. Only active retaliation would deter the Arabs. Only Jewish armed force would ensure the Jewish state." Pretty basic. Another summation of Zionist revisionism. Depending on your perspective on modern Jewish history, the Irgun were either freedom fighters or terrorists. Right? Depends on how you want to come down on it. Now, I would argue that perhaps they were both. That's entirely possible as well. Maybe they used terrorist methods to achieve noble goals.
But isn't that all history points to any rebellion of both?
Could be. Well, some are just terrorists, yeah.
Well, I mean, they might call themselves freedom fighters.
Oh, what they call themselves is one thing, but it's how we look at them.
All right, but I'm saying within the ranks, that's...
Yeah. Oh, they see themselves as being noble and just and doing the right thing, or they wouldn't be doing it. Obviously, you're absolutely correct. They believe in a Jewish state by any means necessary. You know, it was a literally take no prisoners. Or, you know, I love how he glosses over this. He says, you know, we overcame the British soldiers on the truck. Well, you know what that means, right? They killed them. They ambushed them and they killed them. But it was for the greater good. And they were at war and they felt that that was legitimate. So you saw, in addition to the famous King David Hotel bombing, by the way, in 1948, they gained infamy for the Deir Yassin massacre of Arab Jews who stayed in their homes, and then they were killed, and Eric Sharon was involved in that. There's a lot of interesting stuff about them. We talked about what they morphed into, the Chirut and the Likud parties. It numbered over the years from a few hundred people in the beginning to a few thousand. It wasn't a massive movement, but it was a highly structured movement. They had cells. And later, in the end of the British rule, when they were really underground, they had nom de jure, you know, not their real names, and they were in hiding. And there's famous pictures of Begin. I think it's Rabbi Sassan or something that he's disguised as. He goes to morning minyan every day to keep up the front. Very interesting. They put out an underground newspaper to tell their side. They ran the first independent Hebrew radio station. It's called Kol Zion Aluchemet, the voice of the fighting Zion. It was, of course, born out of frustration with the Haganah and what they felt was the lack of what the Haganah was doing, which was part of the overall frustration with the Zionist organization. They disagreed on everything. They disagreed on strategy. They disagreed on tactics. They disagreed on PR. They disagreed on targets. You know, what was a valid target? The Irgun, you know, if a Jew was killed somewhere, then the Irgun would go and target an Arab. Wouldn't matter who, they'd grab someone off a bus and kill him. And then would say, this was in retaliation for such and such. To be fair to them, the Arabs were doing the same things, right? Now, we can have our own debates as to whether or not you want to be like that or not. That's a different question. The first leader was a guy named Avraham Tehomi, T-E-H-O-M-I. He, like all the initial leaders from the Irgun, were, guess from what city? Odessa. Odessa, you got it. It's a magical city. I went to Odessa once, and or a tour, you know, Jabotinsky lived there, Haram lived there, Bialik lived there. I mean, it's just like wherever you go in Odessa, in the Jewish quarter, somebody famous lived. By the late 30s, the Irgun started attacking Arab villages. The goal was to instill fear in the Arabs, to control their own irregulars, to stop the Arabs from saying, hey, the moon is out tonight, let's go kill a few Jews. The Irgun commander David Raziel put it this way. He actually stayed commander of the Irgun until the late 30s, and he actually went back to the Haganah. The actions of the Haganah alone will never be a true victory. If the goal of war is to break the will of the enemy, and this cannot be attained without destroying his spirit, clearly we cannot be satisfied with solely defensive operations. Such a method of defense that allows the enemy to attack at will, to reorganize and attack again, and does not intend to remove the enemy's ability to attack a second time, is called passive defense, and ends in downfall and destruction. Whoever does not wish to be beaten has no choice but to attack. The fighting side that does not intend to oppress, excuse me, but to save its liberty and honor, he too has only one way available, the way of attack. Defensiveness by the way of offensiveness, in order to deprive the enemy the option of attacking, is called active defense. They were all about taking it to the enemy. This was very different than the Haganah. Even today, what's the Israeli army called?
Defense Force.
Israel Defense Forces, IDF. They're not meant to be an offensive operation. All types of philosophical debate says to me, a good defense is a good offense and what have you, but at least the way it was set up, it was meant to defend the people of Israel in the land of Israel. He's saying that I reject that. That's not sufficient. So let me give you an example of some things that happened. Between April 1936 and the end of World War II, some 250 Arabs were killed by the Irgun. They responded to shootings on Jews waiting in Tel Aviv for the Jaffa-Jerusalem train. So within a day or two, the Irgun attacked a train on that route, killing an Arab and injuring five. Another time, a Jew praying at the Western Wall on Shabbat was shot. A few hours later, Irgun shot an Arab in Jerusalem. Arab, send my regards.
Sorry.
It's all right. Arabs attacked a bus on the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv road, killing a Jew. The next day, two Jews killed Arabs near a settlement. There was a string of responses. Now, I don't want to give you the picture that there was horrible violence going on all the time everywhere. An unfortunate parallel is the Second Intifada from the year 2000, late September 2000 to roughly 2003, 2004, where there are horrific bus bombings going on and things like that. It instilled fear because there was nowhere to go. And people were still, you know, until 1939, arriving in the country. By 1939, we've mentioned it before, the white paper outraged everybody. If we recall, it said 75,000 more immigrants over the next 5 years, 15,000 a year, and then it would be up to a majority of the country's population as to how many more Jews would be allowed in. That meant none, because the majority would be Arab. So the Irgun said, it's time to attack the British. It's time to sabotage their infrastructure. Trains, military vehicles, their buses transporting troops, their military bases, nothing is off limits. And indeed, there's all types of rumors, hearsay, no one's ever proven anything about the King David Hotel bombing. Some say that the Irgun called and said, we're going to blow up the King David Hotel, and the operator said, yeah, right, and hung up. Others say they never called. At this point, if we don't know the truth, I don't think we're ever going to know the truth. But the fact that they could carry out that operation speaks of the sophistication and the threat to the British that several thousand were. And while there were only several thousand fighters, they had a lot of sympathy amongst the population. Remember, this guy's mother was cleaning weapons. You know, my mom was pouring milk glasses when we were kids. But this guy's mother was cleaning weapons for the Irgun. Beitar was a feeder to the Irgun, which made total sense. Right? And all the Beitar kids were being trained out in the countryside for weapons training. And they would go sometimes age 16, 17, on missions a little earlier than later. Let's see if I have time. I'm going to mention real quickly, the Irgun, however, wasn't the most right-wing group. That was the Stern Gang. And some of you might have heard of them. They were really nasty. Goes by a Hebrew named Lehi. Let me see what I have on them. And there's Abraham Yair Stern. And Lochmei Chirut Yisrael, the fighters for free Israel. Never more than a few hundred. Right? The Irgun was a few thousand, these guys were a few hundred, but they really made their mark. Founded in August 1940 Gesundheit, by Abraham Yair Stern, the Irgun was too tamed for him. Most famous alum is Yitzhak Shamir, who became Prime Minister of Israel after Begin. They split from the Irgun to continue fighting the British after the Irgun, early into World War II, decided they wouldn't attack the British, at least at that point, to maintain Zionist discipline, which was important at that moment. Unlike the Irgun, they saw themselves really as hardcore socialists / communists, and even some of them were anarchists. But they weren't socialists in the labor Zionist sense. They admired the Soviet Union. We're talking about the Stern Gang. They admired the Soviet Union other than its anti-Semitism. They wanted to break the imperialist yoke, and they sought a planned economy, which is communist rhetoric from that era. Some eventually would enter Israeli politics in the Israeli Communist Party, called Maki, which is now merged into one of the Arab parties. They had three main goals: forcefully evict British from Palestine, allow unrestricted immigration of Jews, and form a Jewish state. Well, not so different from Irgun, but the Irgun at this point still didn't want to evict the British from Palestine. They wanted them to live up to the Balfour Declaration. They declared they wanted a Jewish state based on nationalist and totalitarian principles. Stern argued that the time for diplomacy is over. We've tried that for 50 years, 60 years. No, thank you very much. He refused to, quote, die for the foreign occupier and, quote, enemies of the Jewish people. He said the Brits needed to be defeated and the Nazis needed to be manipulated. He still thought you could deal with the Nazis. The final solution was not in practice yet. All right, there was plenty of killing by the Einsatzgruppe, but no final solution yet. He actually sought an alliance with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. He said he would help Nazis fight the British if they would allow for the transfer of Jews in Germany to come to Israel. So again, we have this fascination on the right with the fascist, viciously anti-Semitic groups. To defend them, I guess is not a good word, but to at least understand their perspective, it wasn't what it was about to become, although many now can see that it was happening no matter what. In fact, in late 1940, a Stern Gang representative went to Beirut to meet a German official who was also involved with the transfer agreement. And the Stern Gang man said, "We can sabotage British installations for you. We're few, but we're good. And we're going to spy on the Brits for you. This was in exchange for your recognizing an independent Jewish state and your kicking all the Jews out and saying they need to come here to the land of Israel." So then, on January 11th, 41, the German naval attaché in Turkey files a report with the German ambassador in Turkey conveying the Zionist offer. That message was sent to Berlin, but there's no record of a response. We don't have anything on that. They had a unique approach to funding their operations. It was called bank robberies. They would rob banks in Tel Aviv and steal money to fund their operations because they couldn't get it any other way. Meanwhile, they would try to assassinate the head of the British secret police in Palestine. They did kill three policemen. Ben-Gurion helped the British hunt down Stern. And I'm going to leave you on the note of how Stern was killed. Stern was the founder, of course. Details of his death remain disputed until this day. He was on the run. The British were hunting him. The labor Zionists were looking out for him. He had a main contact through which he passed messages on to the rest of the Stern Gang. Her name was Kasia Shapiro. One day a message came from Haganah saying that we're offering you a safe house from the Brits if you stop your operations now, if you stop your violence against the British. Stern wrote a letter to Haganah declining the offer, but he was suggesting some cooperation with Haganah to defeat the Brits. He wasn't giving up his dream. A few hours later, three British detectives arrived at the apartment where Stern was staying. They looked around. They couldn't find him. Finally, in the back of a closet, they reached a hand back there, and they grabbed some hair, and they pulled him out. They had found Yitzhak Stern, the number one man on their wanted list. It said he was then sitting on the couch, and depending on who you want to listen to, he leapt out a window, and they shot at him and killed him, or he was shot in cold blood sitting there.
And then leapt out the window.
Yeah, and then leapt out the window, right. This is from the official police report. It was neat that I found this. Stern was just finishing lacing his shoes when he suddenly leapt for the window opposite. He was halfway out the window when he was shot by two of the three policemen in the room. Now, the senior policeman on the scene, a guy named Jeffrey Martin, wrote in his memoirs that they were afraid that Stern was about to set off a bomb. So they shot him. He said, it's poppycock.
Bombs.
shoe bombs, who knows. They said it's probably God. So, and he was shot 3 times. So what we've done tonight is really added a significant page to our study of Zionist history. We added the whole right wing, which doesn't get as much attention in history books as the labor Zionists, and for good reason. The labor Zionists built the infrastructure that became the state. But these guys were very important, and they were very popular, and they had some really crazy people involved with them, too. So they're very interesting to study. Any questions on anything? No? All right.
People in Israel who supposedly would know say that the Brits did know.
That the Brits what?
The Brits knew that the King David, they gave them...
Yeah, I've heard both.
You're right,
yeah.
And the Brits said, "Yeah, you know, we don't care."
Right. Right, both stories are out there. No, they said, "We don't believe you." What are you? That was British military headquarters in Palestine.
They couldn't possibly...
Right, how can they get in here? How can they get in here? It was a horrific and sensational attack, as you just saw, 91 dead. I mean, they, you know, crashed in a whole corner of the hotel. And you've seen the hotel if you've been there. That's a big structure.
In Stanislavski's book,
yeah,
there was some comment that Jabotinsky, that the Kishinev pogrom was not an impetus for him to...
Yes. Yes, I disagree with that, and I've read elsewhere otherwise. When I read Stanislavski, I don't know what to trust. I've read another book by him, too, because in part he comes up with such stuff that's so original, but I don't think he gave really enough background in that, from what I recall. So it didn't strike me, so I don't go with it.
Okay. He seems to take everything and just, like, refute the Shekman who wrote...
Right, it's very pro-Jabotinsky.
But the author, Stanislavski, like, knocks everything and he changes everything.
Right. I think Stanislavski is a contrarian. He's clearly brilliant, and his language ability is clearly phenomenal. But he's a contrarian. So I'm going to talk to David Stern. I'd like to find another book for next year for the course. That one just doesn't do it for me. Although I understand the different take on history. I appreciate that. All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you. Oh, good.